Cathedral. Hundreds of mourners are saying goodbye to the woman President Obama calls the godmother of the civil rights movement, Dorothy Height.
Look at her body of work. Desegregating the YWCA, laying the groundwork for integration on Wednesdays in Mississippi, lending pigs to poor farmers as a sustainable source of income, strategizing with civil rights leaders, holding her own, the only woman in the room, Queen Esther, to this Moses generation.
Mr. Obama delivering the eulogy this morning at Height's funeral at Washington's National Cathedral. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org.
News from NPR is made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
You'll find thousands of used albums, most for just $1, plus CDs, videotapes, DVDs, and working stereo equipment at the Vintage Vinyl Sale, Saturday, May 8th at Lincoln Square Village in Urbana. Proceeds benefit the Illinois Radio Reader.
Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The Internet offers a place for all kinds of people to express all kinds of opinions about the politics of the day. So what really do we know about these people and what motivates them to write and to put their ideas out there? And here's another question. Who is it that follows them? Who regularly reads all of this political information that's there on the Internet? And what are they looking for? How many of the people who are big readers of political websites and look at political blogs, how many of them are truly interested in having their ideas challenged, what they already think, and how many of them simply want to have vindication? This morning in this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking a little bit about blogs, political messaging, and voter motivation. And our guest for the program is John Sides. He is professor of political science at George Washington University in Washington, D.C. And he does writing and research in a number of areas, including media and politics, public opinion, campaigns, and elections. And he's written quite a bit on this very subject, on the kinds of information that voters are interested in and what it is that influences them. And he agreed to spend some time talking with us this morning, and we're pleased to have him as a guest. Questions are certainly welcome, questions from people who are listening, questions and comments. And you can be involved in the program in two different ways. You can call here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, so if it would be a long-distance call, use that number. That's 800-222-9455. You may also email your comments and questions to will-talk, just like it sounds, W-I-L-L-talk at illinois.edu. So at any point here, questions, comments are welcome. We just hope people will be brief. That will help us get in as many different callers as possible. But, of course, anybody who is listening is welcome to join the conversation. Professor Sides, hello.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. We appreciate it. Just as I suppose we could make the point, maybe we really don't need the point, but we really could make the point, that now, because of the Internet, there is an enormous amount of information available about politics, political and social issues, government, not only from the kinds of things people like to refer to as the mainstream sources, but also things that came into being because of the web. Some of them actually look kind of like magazines and newspapers. They're aggregators. They do have original content. Some of them are smaller, and they're maybe one person or a group of people who gets together and decides they have some things to say, and they want to put it out there. Can you talk a little bit about just how much growth there's been in these kinds of information sources?
Well, I think you've seen tremendous growth. You've gotten, first of all, every mainstream media outlet, news outlet, producing content on the internet, independent of the content it produces in print or the content it produces on the air. So reporters are being asked to be bloggers, and news media outlets are hiring people basically to be bloggers and to write for them and their websites on a regular basis. In addition to that, you have, as you describe, these blogs that basically bubble up from ordinary citizens, by and large, including myself and my colleagues who blog. And here you can, I mean, this is the traditional model of a blog. It's really one person's view, or it's a group of people's viewpoints, unconnected from the traditional news sources.
And that is indeed one of the things, as people have talked about, the potential benefits of the internet. That is one of the benefits, that is, relatively easily, without having to spend a whole lot of money or maybe having a lot of sophisticated expertise, it is possible for an individual to do that. It's not that big a deal anymore.
That's right. I mean, the startup costs to being a blogger are minimal. I mean, you have websites, Blogspot or Google Blogs, that basically, you know, make the format of the blog already available for you. And all you have to do is plug in, you know, the name of it and any of the identifying information you want to provide. I think, I mean, the challenge, though, is that this sort of image of plucky bloggers, you know, little Davids taking on the media Goliaths, I mean, we have to have a fairly, I think, qualified view of the ability of any individual person to become sort of a big cheese by blogging. Because I think the mainstream news outlets have become so, I think, quick to appropriate these technologies for themselves. I mean, if you look at the blogs that are most read in politics, I mean, a large number of them are affiliated with mainstream news organizations. And then what you also see in that group of blogs are some that kind of started, you know, from nothing, you know, back in the early days before there were many of these blogs. And they became, you know, more popular over time. But now that the market is more saturated, you know, it's going to be difficult for any one person to make a splash and sort of rise through the ranks to become somebody that, you know, thousands of people read and follow.
Yeah. The people that are doing the blogging, particularly the people that are that have become influential and have a lot of readers, are these people, do you think, that might otherwise be journalists, and that this is something that they would be doing were it not for the internet and the opportunity to blog? Or are there a lot of people that, you know, who knows what they would have been doing, but they wouldn't be doing this without the internet and
right.
without the opportunity to
right.
blog.
I don't know if these folks would have ended up in journalism. I mean, I think the way that I perceive a lot of the big political blogs that kind of grew from nothing to become dominant, you know, they really got started because people had political opinions. And you know, journalists are obviously asked to submerge their political opinions for the most part. And if they're doing traditional news reporting, you know, they're asked to write relatively objectively about the events they're describing. So I don't know if there would have been a home for these folks in journalism, except perhaps on the editorial page. And it's, the other thing that's clear, at least in a few cases, is that at least as these blogs have grown over time, you know, they've really become focused on building, you know, a political movement or mobilizing people to get involved in politics and political issues, you know, obviously on the side of the blogger, him or herself. So, you know, again, that's a different kind of motive than I think traditional journalism provides. And so for these kinds of people, I think the internet's been a tremendous resource.
Well, that's that was maybe a question that I was heading for, was whether there's reason to think that some of these people would – they're interested in grassroots political organizing, and would they be doing that otherwise, maybe just doing it in a different way?
That's entirely possible. You know, it just depends. I think some people's personalities lend themselves to that kind of work, and some people's personalities lend themselves to sort of, you know, sitting at home with their laptop and maybe trying to do the same thing, but from a very different place.
Do if you look again at the wide range of now these websites that are really devoted to news about politics and that also do include commentary, the kinds of things that you find on the op-ed page of the newspaper, for example, if you look at the mix of elements that you would say truly were journalism and those things that you would have to say truly are commentary, are opinion, how do you see the mix of those two things? Or maybe it just it's different from one side to the next.
I think that the political blogs, for the most part, some are largely aggregators, as you pointed out. I mean, there's relatively little independent content that they're providing. Other blogs, I think, probably skew much more towards opinion than commentary. And this may be kind of what people have in mind when they think of this sort of average political blog. You know, it's a person that has a lot of strong opinions about politics. The mixture of politics and reporting, I mean, I think is a little bit less common. And it's only really gained, I think, a market share recently. And so these are people who have developed a large enough institutional presence as bloggers that they can either because their blogs generate enough income that they can afford to do this, or because they've been brought on board by traditional news organizations who have these resources, now they can actually go out there and collect information themselves, get their phone calls returned, and actually follow news stories, and occasionally even break news that other outlets don't yet have. But I think that for those kinds of outlets are relatively rare as opposed to those that just provide opinion.
Yeah. And that, I suppose, leads to a question like this. Do we know something about how many bloggers have this as essentially a hobby, and for how many people it actually has become a job?
I can't give you a very specific percentage, but I'm pretty confident that the number of people for whom this becomes a job is very, very small. It's just simply not easy to make money doing this. If you think about, you go to your average website and you see maybe in the margins of the blog, you see like advertisements, you know, from Google Ads or from other kinds of sources. I mean, for those to generate money for the blogger, a lot of people have to click on them. I mean, you have to have a large number of readers, and they have to be willing to click on these things. And I just think that's not very common. And so, as a consequence, for most people, it's really just a sideline. It certainly is for me. I'm not making any money doing it. Yeah.
Our guest in this first hour of Focus is John Sides. He's professor of political science at George Washington University in Washington, D.C., and has written a lot about American politics. Particularly, he's interested in things like media and politics and public opinion. And we're talking here about the proliferation of websites, particularly things that are something that are started by individuals because they feel they have things that they want to say about politics. And just what do we know about people who do this blogging, what we know about the people who read them, and what we know about what kind of impact these things have on politics, and whether, in fact, that it influences people's opinion, whether it influences their political involvement, whether it influences the way that they vote. Questions, comments, welcome, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. And you may also email your comments to will-talk@illinois.edu. We do have a caller here. We'll bring into the conversation somebody in Morris on our toll-free line. Hello, line four.
Yes, good morning. The topic of what you're discussing here is of great concern, in my opinion, that it can sway votes. I think there's a lot of disinformation out there. I usually rely on the judgment of the persons looking it up to see where these people are writing the blogs from. I personally think a lot of the stuff that's on the internet nowadays is some of it's It's just misinformation. It's garbage. But then people tend to you know, especially the extremists, tend to believe a lot of this stuff that's printed. I was just wondering, you know, how, is there any way to screen this stuff? Is there any way that maybe a government entity or somebody can screen it? Because it's, some of this stuff is really liable towards politicians and anybody that like for now, anybody that goes against, say, the left. If you're somebody that's not a righty or in between, you know, if you don't agree with somebody on the left, it seems like you get hate mail and people are giving death threats out there. I don't know. What do you think? I'll get off and listen. Thank you.
Well, the caller has raised a number of points. We can try to get all of this, but maybe let me just pick one to start with and to ask whether there's been some effort, and this would be very difficult, I think, because of the scope of what we're talking about here, but there is some effort to assess the information that you find on political blogs just to try to say, well, is it accurate or not?
Right. I mean, I don't know of any large-scale effort, in part because, obviously, there's a lot of content to read, and in part because judgments about its truth or fiction are sometimes, you know, have a degree of subjectivity. I think there is obviously a growth in a number of organizations which are doing fact-checking on a regular basis. PolitiFact.com is one. FactCheck.org is another. And these have affiliations with mainstream news sources or with academic institutions. And I think they have the ability to point out when news outlets or politicians or whomever make statements that are misleading. That said, mm-hmm. you know, I think their voices are still small. And obviously, I think the caller's right to point out that one of the potential costs of being able to put information in the public sphere quickly with relatively low cost and then, you know, sort of have that information move quickly, because obviously it doesn't take a lot of work to link to somebody else's website and sort of repeat something that they said. You know, the challenge of that is it's going, you know, it's like a little sort of brush fire. You know, when these rumors start, it may be difficult to squelch them. Unfortunately, there's very little the government can do per se, in part because obviously political speech is by and large protected constitutionally. So misleading claims that one might make, let's say, about, you know, a consumer product are regulated, but misleading claims that, you know, we might make about politicians or political issues are not. And in fact, the standards for libel of political leaders are also extraordinarily high, such that, you know, for all the criticism that American presidents endure, there's very little they could do in terms of legal redress for the kinds of claims that people make as a consequence of these standards. So again, the court's stance on this, the Supreme Court's stance on this, has been, you know, obviously fairly protective of speech, and that means that as voters, as consumers, as citizens, you know, the burden falls on us to make sense of it.
Yeah, and anybody who would say that they cared about the First Amendment and free speech, I think, would be horrified at the idea of having the government screening people's blogs.
Right. But then the question is the caller, I think, is right to point out: is there some mechanism by which we can try to figure out the answer to this? And again, I think there are ways to do that, but it takes a lot of initiative. And I mean, what we would like to be the case is that to some extent, the, you know, let's call it just sort of the media broadly, you know, including traditional news outlets, including blogs, including, you know, the blending of these things. We'd like to think that it has it's somewhat self-policing, in the sense that, you know, at least mainstream news outlets have obviously certain kinds of standards that they have to uphold, at least most of the time. And also, you know, these news sources are paying attention to each other. And so you might find cases where a concerted effort by one segment of the media
can identify problems in stories that other segments of the media have produced. And again, I mean, the challenge is a lot of that kind of conflict breaks down along partisan lines. So obviously, you know, news sources or you know, editorial sources and blogs aligned with the left find a lot that's problematic about what the right is saying, and vice versa. But nevertheless, I mean, you know, the hope is that with a multitude of voices or a plethora of voices, there's at least a chance that the outcome of that conversation, if you want to call it that, gets us somewhere or a little bit closer to the truth. Mm-hmm. But again, that might be an ideal that's difficult to be realized.
What do we know about people who are big readers of political information, and that indeed, again, could be a wide range of things? Could it be anything from mainstream media on the web to, say, new or emergent media on the web that are still big aggregators and news sources that kind of look like newspapers and magazines, all the way over to blogs that may be very personal expressions of one individual's viewpoint? If you'd say people who are spend hours and hours, and you can, in front of your computer reading right. stuff like that, what do we know about them?
Sure. If you could imagine a spectrum that goes from like the largest sort of online news sources, you know, Yahoo News, sort of the more prominent political blogs. As you go along that spectrum, what you're seeing is a smaller and smaller group of people, you know, that are reading these things. So obviously Yahoo News has, you know, millions upon millions of users every day. You know, and political blogs have much smaller audiences by and large, even the biggest ones. So as you're sort of whittling down the group of readers, what you're gradually isolating is a group of people that are obviously much more interested in politics. It takes, you know, a lot of people want to keep up with the news or to follow what's going on in a general way, but to read political blogs is to really be more invested in knowing details about events, in hearing interpretations of those events, maybe from a partisan or ideological point of view. And for this group of people, they are almost unanimously very interested in politics, according to the research I've participated in. They are more likely to identify strongly with either political party, and they are more likely to position themselves toward sort of the endpoints of the ideological spectrum. So they're going to be stronger liberals and stronger conservatives. So these people look like, you know, your sort of traditional kind of political junkie in part. They care a lot about it, and they have strong opinions about it.
And are there more liberals, more conservatives, or are they pretty much about even?
Our data suggests a slight tilt toward the left side of the political spectrum among people who read political blogs, in that people who identify as liberal or very liberal, let's say, are a little, perhaps a slight bit more numerous than people who identify as conservative or very conservative. And the same thing's true if you look at sort of people's identification as a Democrat or Republican. That, again, like I don't want to make too much of that. It's a small tendency. It's not a chasm. It may reflect to some extent the prominence and success of some of the largest left-leaning blogs, the Huffington Post, which sort of become more than a blog now, and also the Daily Kos. The two of those, I think, you know, have very large audiences, and so that may be one reason why we observe this small tilt. But I think, in general, obviously, you're going to find a fairly wide range of political views represented among political blogs.
Mm. Our guest in this hour of Focus, let me just very quickly reintroduce, is John Sides. He's professor of political science at George Washington University in Washington, D.C. He's interested in the areas including media and politics, public opinion, campaigns, and elections. And we're talking here about blogs, political messaging, voter motivation. Trying to talk a little bit about this, the explosion of political information that's available on the internet, particularly things that are very much expressions of individual attitudes, ideas, and opinions. Talking a little bit about who it is that creates these sites, who reads them, and what sort of political impact they have. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. One of the big questions here, and it seems to be one that, you know, different people have different opinions on, or maybe that they have reason to say that that's not just an opinion, that they have some data that will show one thing or another, is when you look at people and the information sources that they seek out and read, is it the case that people are looking for opinions that line up with theirs, that essentially what, as I said at the beginning, they're looking for validation? Or are there significant numbers of people who are at least willing to read opinions and ideas that are diametrically opposed to theirs?
Yeah, this is the big question. Mm. And obviously people have raised a lot of fears about the Internet's ability to allow us to create cocoons for ourselves.
Right. Yeah.
So here I want to make a distinction between just sort of news sources on the one hand and political blogs on the other. Mm-hmm. The best sort of research that's been done on news consumption online is that it's not as ideologically segregated as we might think, and that the average, you know, news consumer's exposure, you know, it may tilt a little bit towards, you know, news sources that are identified with the left or news sources that are identified with the right. But that's a tilt. It's not an ironclad tendency. And in part, this reflects the fact that, you know, if you look at mainstream news outlets on the Internet, I mean, they're very large, you know, websites that get lots and lots of readers. And so as a consequence, then, it's not necessarily the case that it's going, these groups of readers are going to be, you know, so skewed towards one side or the other. When you get to political blogs, however, the story changes, because now you're looking at a much smaller group of people who have a much deeper interest in politics. And this is where our research can inform us. We find that, by and large, people who read political blogs tend to read blogs that are either associated with the left wing or associated with the right wing. We call these people carnivores, right? They want red meat. And the people that are omnivores, you know, that might eat or, you know, sample blogs from both sides are relatively rare, you know, a very small fraction of the population. And if you look at the viewpoints of people that read exclusively left-wing blogs or right-wing blogs, obviously their views on issues are quite close to the endpoints of the, you know, the scales that we can create based on sort of survey questions that ask people, you know, their views on different kinds of political issues. Mm-hmm. So what it ends up looking like is that blog readers are fairly polarized. You know, if you read left-wing blogs, you know, you're pretty far on the left side of the spectrum, at least as far as we can measure it, okay? And then secondly, if you read right-wing blogs, you're on the other side. Yeah. And there's not a lot of overlap.
Well, that, and just real quick, and I promise I have a caller here I want to get to. I want to go back to one of the contentions are one of the ideas that the first caller tossed out, the idea that the things that we're talking about, political blogs and other political sites on the web, sway votes. This, what you've said, makes it sound as if that for a lot of people, they're the kind of people that we would describe as political junkies. They're heavily into politics, but they know what they believe. They and it sounds like they're fairly committed to a particular kind of ideology, and that they're reading a lot of stuff that lines up with that. So it's not likely that a person like that is going to, they're not going to read something on the web and just one day look up and say, oh my God, everything I thought was wrong, and I'm going to suddenly go over to the other side. It sounds like that's, it may make them more committed and more active, but it's not going to result in a big change in where they are politically.
Yeah, I think the social science sort of perspective would back you up on that. If people who read political blogs are, you know, pretty opinionated and pretty politically involved, they're not the kind of people whose viewpoints, you know, sort of blow with the wind. Mm-hmm. And if they are affected by what they read, it's like, as you describe, it's likely to reinforce their views, maybe strengthen their views, maybe mobilize them to take action based on those views. But ultimately, I mean, we really don't know much yet about the causal effect of reading blogs. You know, you can imagine that people who let's say, read political blogs, you know, go there, learn things, you know, maybe their views are reinforced, maybe they move even further toward an extreme. Or maybe people who already have those views just go to have them reinforced, and so really there's no change. So the polarization that I'm describing is not necessarily a consequence of reading blogs. It might just reflect people's viewpoints when they begin to read blogs, you know, as they start to sort of you know, look at more information about politics. And ultimately, you know, this is one of the challenges for us as social scientists, is figuring out what the causal impact is of these new media sources.
Let's talk with someone here. We have a listener in Terre Haute, Indiana, line 4. Hello.
Hello. I'm wondering if you distinguish between political blogs and hate blogs, because it seems to me that some of the blogs are designed to just creatively develop ideas that have no fundamental basis in any fact at all.
In our research, we don't have any distinction along those lines. We were mainly interested in distinguishing political blogs from non-political blogs. And in the survey that we're relying on, there was a large number of respondents. There were an enormous number of blogs named that people read. And so we were just trying to make sense of that long, long list. I think the caller raises a concern, which gets at the fact that there are, you know, there's little policing and there's relatively few costs to saying things that might be inflammatory. And, you know, here again, we're, you know, sort of back in the same conundrum. We want to live in a political marketplace in which information flows freely. And yet, at the same time, we want to sort of have some standards by which, you know, we can judge and perhaps even regulate that information. And there's no easy solution for that. All we can hope, ultimately, is that the percentage of people who would be motivated by things that they read online to actually do things that we would describe as hateful or even violent is just too small, you know, or small enough that we have perhaps less to fear than we might otherwise. But it still doesn't make anybody feel good to know that these kinds of ideas are circulating.
Other questions, comments, they're certainly welcome here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. You know, we're talking about this question of blogs and whether or not they are polarizing and whether whether people are seeking out opinions different from theirs or whether essentially they're looking at writing that already lines up with what they think.
Right.
It seems that there's a group of people that are sort of in the middle that are grazing and they're kind of sampling a lot of different things, but that they're also in the more things that were closer to the mainstream kind of sources, and that then they're the people who are really committed, they're really into politics, and they're probably very committed to a particular ideology, either right or left. They're the ones who are more likely to read the hardcore political blogs because they're in it at a much deeper level.
Yep.
And I don't know if it's possible to answer a question like this, but it seems that we have more people who are kind of in the middle who are increasingly disenchanted by politics and feel distanced from them. So that leaves the political ground to the real hardcore people on the either side. Is that contributing, you think, to a greater maybe polarization in politics? And then I suppose one would have to say, well, does the internet somehow facilitate that, or maybe would that be happening anyway?
Sure. Some research on the sort of the development of different media choices suggests that when you proliferate, let's say, information about information on the web or information on cable TV, which obviously offers us seemingly infinite number of channels these days. One of the consequences of that is that people who don't necessarily have a lot of interest in politics can find many, many, many other things to watch or read, things that have to do with sports or entertainment or what have you. And so it may be the case that, that their sort of interest in politics is therefore, you know, weakened. It's not going to be nurtured even marginally by the information that you might encounter just by chance, you know, in the days of, let's say, you know, three major television networks when you didn't have so much to choose from. So this might, in fact, mean that there is sort of an exit of moderate voices from politics, and that leaves people who have much stronger opinions more dominant. So I think, you know, that's a real possibility. There are other kinds of trends driving polarization at the among political leaders, which are separate from anything that's happening in the mass public. And so, if we wanted to talk about the sources of polarization in American politics, we would want to look at a lot of broader structural changes that are happening, such as, for example, the ways in which the Democratic control of the South disappeared and Republicans became more dominant. And so over time, what you have is, you know, Democrats in Congress are increasingly, you know, on the liberal side, and Republicans on Congress are increasingly on the conservative side, and there are very few conservative Democrats, and there are very few liberal Republicans. And so that is, there are some trends going on in Congress that I think are important. So I lay that out there just to make it, this is not a blame the Internet story. Mm-hmm. It should not be a blame the Internet story. But I think the trends in the proliferation of new sources and their consequences are not going to do much to reduce any momentum we have towards a more polarized political system.
If you look at people who spend a lot of time in front of their computers reading about politics, and particularly people who do indeed have a strong commitment to one end or the other of the spectrum, do those people, in addition to spending time in front of their computers reading about politics, are they actually active outside in the community in politics in that sort of a way?
Yeah, the answer is yes. And here again, it's not easy to determine whether the information that they read on political blogs actually caused them to get more involved, or whether they're just the kind of person whose level of interest in politics is so high that they will both read blogs and go out and participate in politics. But we do see that there's certainly a correlation that people who read political blogs are more active than those who are not. Interestingly, our research suggests that acts of political participation are more numerous among those who read left-wing political blogs relative to those who read right-wing political blogs. And this is, this is one piece of evidence, and it suggests a tentative conclusion, which may get at the ways in which the left and right wing use the Internet perhaps a little bit differently. In particular, there are some, you know, relatively prominent sites on the left side who are using blogs explicitly to build a political movement. And there, in particular, what they're interested in is a movement, a progressive movement, one that is probably to the left of, you know, many in the Democratic Party, and they're trying to pull the Democratic Party to the left as best they can. And so they're sort of urging their readers to get involved and to support candidates across the country, not just in their local communities, with donations or what have you, that might then have a better chance of winning. On the right wing, of course, obviously there's always an interest in winning elections and so forth, but it seems to be that the most prominent right wing blogs have become more about news and opinion and a little bit less focused on the question of mobilization or motivation. And that may change over time. But right now what we see is some evidence that participation, of course, is more prominent among blog readers. We don't know whether the blogs are causing that, but we also see a slight advantage that people who read left-wing political blogs have in terms of their willingness to participate.
Okay. We have a couple of other callers here. We have about 10 minutes left in this hour of Focus. John Sides is our guest. He is professor of political science at George Washington University. That's in Washington, D.C. He writes and thinks about issues like media, politics, public opinion, campaigns, and elections. And we're talking about the Internet and about the vast range of political information that is on the internet, particularly blogs, some of them very personal expressions of people's opinions, and what we know about people who write these things, about people who read them, and about what sort of influence these sites and these writers have then on politics in a kind of a larger sense. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. Next caller is in Effingham, line 4. Hello.
Yes, thank you, David. I watched Bill Moyers' ending segment of his program, and he had the FCC chairman on, and they were discussing some of this same venue and the weakening and homogenization of news and the influence of the internet, which is destructive, in my opinion. And then my second point would be blend in the new citizens declared by the Supreme Court who have all the money and the influence that's going to have on the political system, and Wilhelm Reich's efforts to expose the mass psychology of fascism, which is where I think we are. That's becoming enormously dangerous. Thank you.
All right. Well, you can react to any of that you like.
Sure. The role of the FCC here is interesting. And I suggested earlier that the government does relatively little to regulate content in terms of speech, but also that, of course, includes content on the media. And what it does is largely regulate basically only two kinds of media. They regulate broadcast television, so ABC, NBC, CBS, not cable television, and they regulate sort of the traditional AM/FM spectrum on the radio, not satellite radio, right? Let's say, and they regulate these because obviously there's limited space on the broadcast spectrum, and so they license segments of that spectrum to local stations, and then in turn, local stations are subject to some regulations. So the internet doesn't fall under that, for the same reasons that cable television and satellite radio doesn't fall under that, because there's no limitation, right? It's largely obviously there are limitations in terms of the speed with which we can provide internet connections, perhaps, but there's no limitation in sort of on the amount of stuff you can stick on the internet. And so this is why the FCC's attitude towards something like internet content is probably going to be even less. They're going to provide even less oversight than they would on these other traditional side. There is a concern about homogenization, as the caller raised, and that this gets at the ways in which news media outlets have become concentrated under, corporate parents who, own larger and larger numbers of different kinds of media outlets. And so, I mean, I guess an open question going forward is the extent to which the FCC, perhaps with new appointees from President Obama, might take a bit more stringent attitude towards that kind of consolidation, and might therefore sort of start to break up, maybe, or at least limit the amount of outlets that corporations can acquire. Similarly, with regard to the Citizens United decision, again, there's not much at this stage that we can do to sort of make this decision go away. However, the question that we are going to watch going forward is the extent to which Congress is going to act to make it somewhat more costly for corporations to spend their own money to advertise in the context of elections. And so one of the things that's being discussed, for example, is to make the disclosure requirements fairly stringent, so that, if you're going to spend your money as a corporation in an election, it's going to be pretty clear that it's you doing it. And it's not going to be easy to hide behind, sort of a made-up name or anything like that. Here again, I mean, interestingly, this is one of those cases where the proliferation of news sources, including those on the internet, might help. I mean, if you want to sort of, if you're concerned that there's going to be a flood of corporate money coming into campaigns and elections, then, to the extent that there are blogs and other sort of non-traditional news outlets paying attention in addition to traditional news outlets, then it might, again, make it somewhat more
costly for corporations to do this because they fear, you know, being caught or being criticized for the kinds of messages that they're presenting. That's not necessarily a perfect solution, and certainly many people disagree with the decision in terms of its you know, philosophy. But nevertheless, there may be some maybe possibilities to sort of to keep corporate money from being a sort of an entirely unregulated part of campaigns.
All right. Let's talk with someone else. Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Hi. Well, I'm derailed from my points because I think you're wrong about the FCC province because it does have regulatory oversight for the phone system and telecommunications. It does have something to say about the internet, and in fact, the way it regulates the internet was changed a little bit ago because the FCC under the Bush administration recast the position of the internet and limits it in a way that limits its ability to regulate things about the internet, such as net neutrality. So it's curious if that comes up, because what I was going to mention, there's preoccupation of the first caller, was that who's fact-checking and how do we know all this stuff is accurate? Well, it's ironic that I think that's Politico, an article in Politico, pointed out that the Sunday morning chat shows, you know, mainstream height of journalism and on the air, does very little fact-checking and allows most absolutely balderdash to be said without an immediate challenge, and they don't report on it later either. So there's a big thing going on right now, and as I say, it was instigated by an article on Politico, as far as I can understand. So it's kind of ironic that it's sort of back at you. Your mainstream media is fretting about all of this on the internet, but so there are two major issues there. One is this question of fact on what the FCC's role could be, the fact checking that doesn't go on in the mainstream press, and without getting too wonkish, and maybe you don't want to spend a whole lot of time on it, is what kind of methodology do you use to? Is this a combination of surveys and focus groups as typically employed, or? And I guess I could hang up and listen since there's very little time left.
We have about 5 minutes. Professor Sides?
Thank you for those questions. I'm happy to address each of them. Your point about the FCC is indeed correct. The FCC has the potential, for example, to regulate the way that Internet providers charge for access, in particular whether or not you raise the concept of net neutrality. What that means is that basically no matter how much bandwidth, let's say, particular internet content takes up, you know, you charge the same no matter what. So if you're using a service that means that you're downloading really large, you know, let's say movie clips, you know, that doesn't cost you any more than if you're just reading the news on the web, like anybody would do. So the FCC will and the courts too will have something to say about whether or not net neutrality is going to be enforced. I was only pointing out that the FCC does little to regulate the actual content in terms of the literal things that people can say and put on the web. And I think there the regulations are minimal. The caller brings up this question about fact-checking. And I think it's a relevant criticism to raise. Oftentimes, given the constraints that news media organizations face in terms of time and energy and the reporting resources that they have, it's easier to go through sort of a routine of what we might call it passive objectivity, which is just, you know, you quote one side and then you quote the other side, and that's that. You know, you don't make any effort to try to determine which side is telling you something closer to the truth for fear, again, of that doing so means not being objective. And so people criticize the news media and want them to do more of this. And I think, you know, you definitely see resistance to that because some journalists don't feel like it's their job to determine who's telling the truth. And here, again, this is where, you know, news sources that are outside of the traditional outlets can provide value. Typically, they do so with a handful of exceptions. They do so with a partisan perspective or an ideological perspective in mind. It doesn't mean that they're not telling you when they say, hey, so-and-so said something false, that they may be right, you know. But again, the challenge is you know, trying to ensure that people's ability to fact-check is not being clouded by their own you know, partisan or ideological sentiment. So I see a role for blogs and other outlets in doing that. It's perhaps not going to be a perfect model, but it definitely does something more than traditional journalists are willing to do. A question about methodology. A social scientist is always happy to answer these kinds of questions. The research that I've done is based on surveys, and here what you can imagine is people were asked if they read blogs, and then they were invited to name them, or at least, you know, a handful of them, and then we could then determine based on what blogs they named what kinds of information they were encountering, you know, whether it was more left-wing or more right-wing in its orientation. So that's one way of answering that question. There are other ways of, you know, looking at news media consumption. The value of doing it with a survey is just that we can ask more detailed questions about people's political attitudes.
We're almost out of time, and I find myself often at this point saying I want to ask you a question, but I can't give enough time really to answer it. But we have this ideal, what we'd like voters to do. We'd like them to be really engaged. We'd like them to be thoughtful. We'd like them to have some background and issues, think about what they think, really investigate what candidates think before they go in and vote for them. It disappoints us when so few voters do that. Can we really expect very many people to be engaged to that degree? Do they really want that?
Clearly there are limits. And there's no way to put a number or a percentage on how many people want to be involved. But clearly, a significant fraction of the public doesn't vote, you know, a third of the public in the 2008 presidential election. And people don't necessarily follow political news or political events with a great deal of care. Maybe that's, in some cases, entirely rational, you know, in the sense that the time and energy they would spend doing that doesn't really pay off. Hmm. It pays off in terms of, like, we can give them a merit badge for being a good citizen, but, you know, we don't necessarily, there's really, for us as citizens, there's not necessarily a lot to be gained by spending a lot of time learning. That doesn't mean we shouldn't, but it's not, so it's a question of convincing people that it's sort of a moral obligation as opposed to sort of a cost-benefit kind of obligation. I think that there's a challenge in doing that. A further challenge, though, would arise if we lived in a society in which people were more engaged and more informed. You know, one of the things that our research finds and other political science research finds is that, you know, people that tend to be more involved and informed about politics tend to have stronger opinions. They are going to be, therefore, less open-minded and perhaps less tolerant of people who have different opinions. And so we can imagine that there are sort of all these ideals that we'd like for people to sort of aspire to at the same time, you know, being informed, being open-minded, being tolerant, but they're actually in significant tension with each other. And so, you know, if we ask for a country that's more informed, we might get a country that's less open-minded or more intolerant. And to have a country that's less informed might mean there's maybe a larger degree of open-mindedness or tolerance. So what we really want in the ideal citizen is someone who cares a lot and reads a lot but is always open to changing their mind and always open to hearing the other side. And I think that's a difficult place to get to.
Well, there we'll have to leave it. Our guest, John Sides, Department of Political Science, George Washington University in Washington, D.C. Professor Sides, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me. I enjoyed it.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the City of Urbana, presenting Urbana's Market at the Square starting this Saturday morning, May 1st at 7 a.m. The market features Illinois-grown produce, fresh flowers and plants, baked goods and food, and original works of art. At the corner of Illinois and Vine Streets, downtown Urbana. Information at 384-2319.
We're going to break for an update on the markets. We'll be back. Stay tuned.
Agricultural information on WILL is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the marketplace where prices have taken off today as the trade continues to digest the news of China buying U.S. corn this week. Let's look at some particulars. In Kansas City, May wheat now at 507¾, up 16¼. July, 516¾, up 14¾. May wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade, 491½, up 15¼. July, 504, up 16. May corn 364.5 up 7.5. July 372.5 up 8.5. December 385.75 up 8. June crude oil not trading on the big board at the moment. May soybeans at 989 up 6.25. July 988 and they are up 4.5. And November soybeans at 972 up 6.